If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
During this difficult time, we want to make it as easy as possible for our readers to get their copy of BBC History Magazine or BBC History Revealed. So for the next few months, we'll deliver your favourite magazine direct to your door with no delivery charge. From today, you can save up to 70% off the shop price and subscribe from just £9.99. That's just £1.66 per issue. There's never been a better time to get your favourite history magazine delivered direct to your home. To take advantage of this unmissable offer, please visit buysubscriptions.com/historyextra and choose your magazine. Don't forget, all of our magazines are also available digitally on your mobile or tablet device. Visit buysubscriptions.com/historyextra for more information. We look forward to welcoming you. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Millie Cawthorne. For today's episode, we have the next in our Everything You Want to Know series. This time, it's on the Viking Age. The expert is Professor Judith Jesch from the University of Nottingham, and asking the questions is our content director, David Musgrove.
Welcome to the latest in our special lockdown Everything You Want to Know series. I'm David Musgrove, content director on BBC History Magazine and HistoryExtra.com. So we've already covered the Norman Conquest, the Tudors, Roman Britain, Prehistoric Britain, D-Day and the Victorians in this series, and now we're turning our attention to the Viking Age. The format is the same as previous editions. We've asked you to send in questions on our social media channels, at History Extra on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, and we've complemented them with a trawl of the most popular Google searches on the topics, and we've come up with a list of big and small questions that you want to know. Today's expert is Professor Judith Jesch. She's Professor of Viking Studies at the University of Nottingham, an expert on all things Viking, but with particular research interests in Old Norse language and literature, runology, and interdisciplinary Viking studies. She also co-curates the virtual museum Vikings in the East Midlands, which you will find at www.ecmi.org. emidsvikings.ac.uk. So that's emidsvikings.ac.uk. She's written numerous books on the topic, most recently The Viking Diaspora, published by Routledge, and Viking Poetry of Love and War, published by the British Museum Press. I met Judith a few years ago when she did a talk at one of our BBC History magazine's semi-regular study days, and she was quite brilliant then on the topic of Viking poetry, so hopefully we'll cover that a bit today. But before we start, Judith, welcome. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure.
No problem. How are you doing with the lockdown? Is it impacting on your research?
I am actually on research leave at the moment, so it forces me to stay in and do my research, which is great.
Good stuff. Before we jump into the questions, can you tell me a bit more about the virtual museum, the emidsvikings.ac.uk? So I've just been having a quick look around it. There's lots of good resources on it. What's the idea?
Well, a few years ago, we had a travelling exhibition organised by the British Museum and York Museums Trust called Viking Life and Legend, which came to Nottingham. This was in 2017 to 18. We also organised to go with that a museum, an exhibition called Danelaw Saga, which complemented the bigger exhibition by focusing on the Danelaw and the part of England where the Vikings actually had the most impact. And we thought everything was so successful at the time that we'd like to somehow preserve some of the events and those exhibitions. So we had the idea of making a museum using many of the same artifacts that were in those exhibitions and complementing them with other material such as place names, runes, personal names, and some fabulous reproductions and designs made by Adam Parsons of Blue Axe Reproductions.
Okay.
So there's a lot of material there, both actual material and things that you can actually use if you're into colouring. The designs are particularly nice for colouring in.
Right. Okay. Okay. So we're going to jump into the questions now, which, we've had from our readers, our listeners, and from Google. So the first question, the ones we need to get into for starters, is the obvious ones: where did the Vikings come from, and who were the Vikings? Those are the most common searches on Google on the topic.
Well, there's a reason why people need to know, because there's not a simple answer to that question. I think if you put 10 scholars and 10 members of the general public into a room and ask them all that question, you'd get at least 25 different answers. So it's not simple. The word Viking, as we use it in English, is actually a borrowing from the modern Scandinavian languages. So it's only been used in English since the early 18th century. But it does go back to an old Norse word, vikingur. The word vikingur referred to a person who did certain things, which could include raiding or exploring or generally traveling and settling elsewhere. I think, though, it's important not to mix up the way the word was used 1,000 years ago with the way we use it today. And today we use it in a fairly general way to refer to groups of people who came from what is now Scandinavia, so Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, and who their main characteristic was that they left Scandinavia and they went around the world, around most of the known world of the time, and had various kinds of impact in places as far apart as Newfoundland and Baghdad, and most of the places in between. Now, these countries were fairly sparsely populated then. So for them to cover such a wide area, I don't think you can just, you can't cover that with a small number of people. And I think what tended to happen is that the Scandinavians encountered and got together with the people they met along these routes. All kinds of people got involved in their activities, in their trading and their settlement. And we can, I think, with some justification, call all those people Vikings if they're doing Viking-type things in that period. I prefer not to talk so much about Vikings, but rather about the Viking Age, which is, slightly contentious. People disagree about how long it really was, but I think if you go for sometime in the 8th century up until around the year 1100, then that's what we think of as the Viking Age. And a lot of what happened in that period, the Vikings were involved in.
Okay.
I don't know if that is a very clear answer, but as I say, it's quite a complex subject, even just defining Vikings in the Viking Age.
No, I think it's very clear, and it just highlights the point that you were saying, that there is some dispute about it. So that's absolutely fine. Right, the next question is a couple of questions actually, which we're going to roll into one, and it's on a topic that you've written about quite a lot. It's about Viking women, and we have a question from Katie Hayes on our Instagram channel. Said, "What were the lives of female Vikings like?" And then another question from Sarah Solnick on Facebook, who asked, "What was the role of women in Viking society?" So sort of conflating those two together is just to find out a bit about the lives of women during the Viking age, I suppose.
Well, of course, I think that's an excellent question. and it follows on from the previous one, because if you belong to the school of thought that Vikings were just large, hairy males who went around with swords and axes killing people, then obviously the women don't really come into it very much. But as I've always said, even that kind of Viking at very least had a mother, possibly a sister or a wife or some daughters. And actually, if we don't restrict our view of the Vikings just to that cliche, then, and if we think about the people who moved around out of Scandinavia in that period, then obviously women were involved. A very good example there is the settlement of Iceland, which was uninhabited before the Vikings settled there. And if they hadn't taken women with them, then Iceland wouldn't exist today. It's a very obvious point. So I think women were involved in most of what we think of as Viking activities. Even the great heathen army, as we call it, the army that invaded England in the 860s, recent research at places like Torksey and Repton has confirmed that even that band of people had women with them. So basically, I think women were the Viking Age, like many earlier societies, was quite divided in terms of gender roles and what people did, but each household was really a kind of common enterprise. So even though men and women had different roles within the household, I think they did a lot together, whether it was at home on the farm in Scandinavia or establishing new settlements in Scotland or Iceland or trading in the East. So, women were involved in every aspect of the Viking Age, I would say.
I suppose maybe what the questioners were asking was to try and get a sense of how patriarchal Viking society was, and how much agency women had within that. I don't know if you, I know you've got views on that. So.
Yeah, no. Well, yes, there's no doubt that it was a patriarchal society. As far as we can tell, women basically lived at home until they got married, and very often their marriage was arranged for them by their father or their brother or their uncle. They didn't have that much choice. But I think once a woman was married, she was very much the mistress of the household. She was in charge of what went on indoors. And as I say, within the household, it was very much a partnership between the mistress of the household and the master of the household. And of course, I think women had a lot of respect for the skills that they had. One thing that I think is always worth remembering, as far as we can tell, the sails for Viking ships were made by women. So the sheep had to be sheared, the wool spun, the sails woven and sewn together from smaller bits. And that's women's work. So the Viking ships wouldn't have got anywhere without the women actually making the sales for it. So that's what I mean about the common enterprise.
Yeah. And the sales thing is a conversation I had with Johanna, Catherine Friedrich's daughter, when I talked to her about her book the other day. It's an absolutely fascinating aspect of the story, isn't it? Before we move on from women, there was a question on Viking warrior women and this observation about the possible grave of a Viking warrior in Birka. We're not going to go into that because you have written about that for our website, historyextra.com. And as I mentioned, I did discuss that with Johanna as well on that podcast. So if anybody wants to know about that, then go to the website, historyextra.com, search on Birka, and you will find some thoughts there. Right, let's move on to food. Emma Lois on Instagram asked, what were Vikings' favourite foods? Did they eat certain foods for certain celebrations? And then there's a Google follow-up, which is, what did they eat while travelling on their ships? Now, I don't know how far you're able to comment on those things. I presume it's quite difficult to know quite a lot of that.
Well, it's a very interesting topic that not much research has been done on. So, I look forward. There are some colleagues in York working on this question at the moment. It follows on nicely from the previous question, since I do think most cooking of food, preparation of food, was the responsibility of women. Although there is also evidence that men sometimes, if they were on a ship without any women to do the cooking, they'd have to do it themselves. I think the short answer is, going back to the very first question, the Viking Age is a long period of time that covers a very wide geographical area, and people, until very recently across the world, people ate what was available and what was seasonal. I think the first thing to say, Vikings were probably not very vegetarian. that's difficult, particularly in some parts of Scandinavia. They did eat a lot of fish, and we know that they introduced deep sea fishing to the British Isles, for example. Already from an early stage, they're exporting dried fish, so air-dried fish, which is very nutritional and very useful if you're going on a long voyage, because it'll keep. They did a lot of dairy farming, so they ate a lot of dairy products. I think probably throughout quite a lot of history, most people ate what we would call porridge, just grains cooked up, boiled up, with possibly a few herbs and things in them. The other thing they're quite notorious for is eating horse meat. And in fact, Icelanders still do eat. They ride their horses and then eat them afterwards. when Christianity came along, this was disapproved of. So there was a period when they didn't eat. So I think they ate what was available. And I think they were quite good at adapting to whatever. For example, when they went to Greenland, where there really is not much to eat, they started eating seal. And I don't know if you've ever had seal soup. I personally think it's the most disgusting thing I've ever eaten in my life. But if you need to survive and you need to eat seal to survive, then you will do it.
I've sadly never had the pleasure of seal soup. I have. I did go to the Lofoten Islands actually a couple of years ago, up on the north coast of Norway, and you can see they still have the big air drying racks for the fish there.
Exactly.
I wasn't terribly tempted to try that either, to be honest. But
it's nice, especially if you put a little knob of butter on the dried fish. They go very well together.
Okay, all right. Well, I've missed out there. Maybe I'll have to go back and have another. Right. Okay. Next question. So this is possibly a bit of a leading question, I guess, from Josh May on Facebook, who asks, "How progressive were the Vikings?" I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I can take that question in two different ways. one way is, I think, people in the Viking Age were enterprising, they were innovative, they were interested in moving forward and making progress. So in that very literal sense of the word, I would say they were progressive. I think possibly the questioner wants to know if they had what we would consider to be progressive attitudes. I'm personally very strongly against kind of judging people in the past by criteria that we have established in our own time. So it comes back to what you were asking earlier about female agency and so on. I think women did have agency, but perhaps not the kind of agency that we have today. So, the women do come into it because a lot of people have this view of Viking women as not oppressed in the way that women have been in some other historical periods. And maybe there's a little bit of something in that.
And of course, we shouldn't forget that Viking society included something which we would consider to be entirely unprogressive, slavery, which, yes. Would rather arve against the questioners of a line if he is thinking that they were a progressive sort of people.
Yes, but there's also quite a lot of evidence for people freeing their slaves and actually giving, for example, in the settlement of Iceland, quite a lot of people are said to have taken enslaved persons with them, and then once they arrived in Iceland, freed them and given them land to enable them to set themselves up. But yes, there was discrimination against enslaved persons and even freed slaves. It took a few generations before they were socially accepted.
Yeah, but I suppose there is a certain sense of equality in their society at some levels with the democracy and the idea of the assemblies and the Icelandic thing assemblies, for instance. So there's something there, perhaps.
I think so. I have a colleague, Keith Reuter, who's working on this at the moment, and he's very clear that the Vikings had a strong concept of equity, and that they would try everything to sort things out, and it's only when things couldn't be sorted out that they might resort to sort of inequitable means to get things.
Okay. Right. The next question is a great question. It's from Chris Hayward at Gladiatus on Twitter, who asks, were there many major differences between the Norwegian, Danish and Swedish Vikings? So asking to apply sort of modern ethnographic labels, I suppose, to them, but they did apply to some extent.
Not so much modern ethnographic labels as modern nations and borders. The nations of Norway, Sweden and Denmark actually came into being during the Viking Age, and the idea of a single monarchy ruling over a single nation evolved in that period. The thing that's important to remember is the simple vastness of Scandinavia. Elsa Rosdahl in her book about Vikings pointed it out, and I've been repeating it ever since, that the distance from the northern tip of Norway to the southern tip of Norway is the same as the distance from the southern tip of Norway to Rome. It's absolutely kind of massive. And the landscape varies enormously. Denmark is, the highest point in Denmark is 187 meters high. Norway is mountains and fjords. Sweden is these forests and lakes. So it's extremely varied. So is there anything that unites these people? And I would say what unites them is partly a common language, which they called the Danish tongue, strangely enough, and to a large extent a common culture as well, as it's held together by language. So there's both variety and diversity. In terms of the Viking expansion, almost every book you read about the Vikings will have a little map showing arrows coming out of these three countries, with the Swedes going east and the Danes coming west and the Norwegians heading off to Iceland and Greenland. It's a bit more complicated than that, because I think there was a lot of mobility within Scandinavia, and you could find Swedes in Iceland and Norwegians in the east just as much.
Okay, good stuff. I can, on that same Lofoten trip I mentioned, we then went across to the top of Sweden and drove down through Sweden. I can attest it is a very long way, and it was mostly trees all the way down, but an interesting journey nonetheless. Next question from Claire Keim, I think, on Facebook. How did they get on with the local people once they decided to settle somewhere? So that's quite a big question, which I'm sure there's lots of variables in play on that one.
Well, yes, there are. There is variety, of course. I mean, if we look at England, I think what once they decided to settle. So we'll leave out the kind of raiding and the killing bit.
Yeah.
maybe the second phase, if you like, when people, and obviously they settled down. They very soon, I think, probably married local people and formed families with them. One of the most important ways local people would influence the incoming Scandinavians was in religion, because in England was a Christian country. The incoming Scandinavians were not Christian, and Christians, it's the commandment, thou shalt have no God but me. Christians are generally at that time very keen to convert other people to Christianity. So one of the things that happened is very soon, I think, they adopted Christianity, although it's quite interesting in some parts of England. You can see a very Scandinavian form of Christianity evolving as the Vikings joined in. They obviously traded with the locals. What we don't know too much about is the exact mixture of population. I mean, did the Vikings live in their own villages and interact with the next village where the English might have been living, or did they live cheek by jowl in the same village, or did they just have a Viking overlord on a large estate where most of the people living on the estate or in the village might not have been Scandinavian? I think their influence on the English language suggests that there was a lot of interaction on a personal level. But that also comes inevitably with immigrants after the first generation or two. Then people start speaking the local language. You can see that with any immigrant group in history. The language doesn't really last more than a few generations.
Are genetic studies shedding much light on that last question?
Yes and no. the problem with genetic studies is, there's two kinds. There's the study of modern populations, and basically, as I think Adam Rutherford has pointed out, everyone who lived in the year 1000 is an ancestor of everyone in Europe today. I can't quite get my head around that, but I do, you know. There's been a lot of movement, and if you go back more than a few generations, obviously your ancestors interact with each other. You don't like have 2 and then 4 and then 8 and then 16 and then 32 ancestors, because there'll be far more people than actually existed 1,000 years ago. So I'm not terrible. The genetic studies can show certain trends. I mean, you can see differences in different parts of the country. So in Northwest England or in Orkney or the Hebrides, you can see there's a higher proportion of people who have similar genetics to people in Norway, for instance. What is happening much more now is working on ancient DNA, i.e. extracting DNA from skeletons. And obviously, we don't have that many skeletons of people from 1,000 years ago, but the geneticists assure me that they're getting around these problems, and they can actually. I went to a seminar only a few weeks ago, which Tom Booth said that within 10 years they'd be able to tell us what proportion of the population 1,000 years ago came from Scandinavia, for example.
Okay.
So watch this space is all I can say.
Okay, yeah. Well, science will charge on, I'm sure. Okay, we've got a few questions specifically on Britain and the occupation or the impact of Vikings in these lands. So the first one is from Paul Orton on Facebook. What were the long-lasting effects of the Viking occupations on the English language? And he wants quite specifically by regions of the Danelaw. So we might not be able to go into quite the level of detail Paul's after, but gives a sense of
of course you'd have to nobody's asked me to define the Danelaw, thank you. That's a complication in itself, but what you can see is different levels of Scandinavian influence on different English dialects in different parts of England. But what I would say is most of what we can still identify as Scandinavian words in the English language today are, because most of these dialect words are not very well known outside their region, or indeed even within their region nowadays, because people move about so much. But there's still plenty of evidence for Scandinavian words in English, which have been adopted into the English language and then just moved around the country. So everyone will say egg rather than a for what you have for your breakfast. That's a Scandinavian word. Everyone will look out the window. That's a Scandinavian word. Everyone has legs. That's a Scandinavian word. There's a wonderful project called the Gersum Project. Gersum itself is a word that no longer exists in English, but it was borrowed into Old English from Old Norse. It means a treasure. So we have lots of these Viking treasures in the English language, and they're charting all these borrowings. And there's quite a even really very basic words in the language, like the pronoun they, originally a plural pronoun, nowadays often used with a singular meaning. So they, their, and them. So I always tell my students every time they open their mouth, practically, they are speaking Old Norse. So the influence is quite considerable, which I think goes back to what I was saying earlier, that there's probably quite a substantial migration of people for them to have that much linguistic influence.
Yeah. I mentioned to you on when we were talking on email that one of my little lockdown projects is to try and get my head around Old Norse, try and understand the basics of it, which obviously I'm not going to be able to do. But reading the book and looking at the language, there are many words which are clearly loan words that have come from that language into English. So it doesn't take too long to find them when you're looking.
No,
at the
but old. It's also fun to see how they develop, because one of my favorite examples is the words shirt and skirt, which the two languages are closely related. So originally there was just one word which referred to some kind of garment. And what English has done is it's used the English word shirt for one particular kind of garment, and it's used the Old Norse word skirt for a different kind of garment.
It's all good fun, isn't it? It's all good fun. Right, we've got a question from Paul Stewarty on Twitter. And I'm slightly paraphrasing his question, because his original question was bemoaning the fact that we'd ignored Scotland in a feature that we've run on the Vikings in the magazine. I'm not entirely sure which feature he's referring to. But anyway, he's basically asking how prominent was their presence in Scotland. And apologies, Paul, for missing out in that feature.
Well, I'm happy to reassure Paul that very prominent, although the same applies as in almost all of my answers. It's a bit more complicated because Scotland didn't really exist in the way it does today. Its early history is a little bit obscure. Then the Vikings came along, and I think it's important to remind people, the people up there don't need reminding, but people in the rest of the UK might need reminding, that once Vikings had settled in the northern and western isles and those parts of mainland Scotland adjacent to the isles, the western isles or the Hebrides remained Scandinavian, so ruled by the Norwegian king until the 1260s, and Orkney and Shetland remained Scandinavian until the middle of the 15th century. So the influence is much more palpable and much more extensive actually than in any other part of Britain and Ireland. So, yeah, the Vikings have, and people in Orkney and Shetland were speaking Norn, some sort of form of Old Norse. Very difficult to say exactly. I mean, many words still survive in their dialect, but they were certainly speaking some form of Old Norse well into that sort of time, maybe the 16th, 17th century.
And of course, there's lots of fascinating remains in Scotland that refer to the Vikings. I think you tweeted a picture of Mace Howe the other day, the prehistoric site with the Viking runes inside it on Orkney. So you know, that's just one example.
I mean, I have to correct you slightly. Everyone thinks they're Viking runes. They're 12th century runes, okay. Even though the word Viking does appear in them. So even in the 12th century, people still thought of themselves as Vikings in some sense.
Well, that's very interesting. Oh, I stand corrected. So who made those markings then? What do we know about that?
Yeah, we know quite a lot about them. The Earl of Orkney, who was called the Rognvaldr, who had an Orcadian mother and a Norwegian father, went on a pilgrimage to or a crusade or a Viking raid or an expedition or a lad's journey out, whatever you want to call it, to the Holy Land. And there was a mixed group of Norwegians, Orcadians and Icelanders. And when they came back to Orkney from their adventures, they had parties in there and possibly a little bit too much to drink. And then they scrawled their names all over the inside of this ancient monument. And so we can pinpoint that to the 1150s. Which is because we know from other sources that's when, and because it refers to people who'd been to Jerusalem. The graffiti say Jerusalem travelers were in here, and we know that that journey to Jerusalem took place in the 1150s.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I personally think that many aspects of what we think of as the Viking Age continued. They crossed over the divide brought about by the coming of Christianity, and it's really only with the Protestant Reformation that life changed really quite drastically in many Viking parts of the world.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
Next question is still in Britain. When and how extensive was Danish occupation on York before they abandoned the city as part of the harrying of the North? So getting quite specific, how English versus Viking slash Danish was York prior to 1069 is the question. So that's from Laurel A. Rockefeller on Twitter.
Okay. Well, York, as I think everyone knows, is an ancient city. It goes back to the Romans, at least. And there was a settlement there even before the Romans. I think it was a little bit in the doldrums at the beginning of the Viking Age. There's not much evidence for what was going on there. Then along came the Vikings and settled there and practiced trade and craft of various kinds. So certainly their influence is, again, palpable. You can find many Scandinavian-type objects. They revitalized the city, the habit in York, but also in other cities in the Midlands and the North of using the word gate to mean street is another example of Old Norse influence on the language. So yes, I'd say it was pretty Viking. But then cities have this way of attracting people from all over the place, and cities are generally really quite cosmopolitan. And I think York was also pretty cosmopolitan. So, I think it's fair to say the Vikings rejuvenated York and set their stamp on it. But as a city, it was quite cosmopolitan.
Okay. Right, we're leaving Britain for a second and going a bit more global, and obviously that's one of the themes in Viking studies, is to understand that, certainly from the British perspective, that it's not just about them coming over here and raiding Lindisfarne and hanging around. There's a lot more to the story than that. So this question is, why don't they get more credit for discovering North America? This is from Leslie Brown on Facebook, who wonders whether it's something to do with the American education system, but I'm sure it's bigger than that.
Well, it's interesting because I'm also partially a product of the American education system, and we were told about Christopher Columbus and nothing about the Vikings. So I think one of the reasons they don't get more credit is actually the dominance of the United States in this discussion. And although many people would like to think otherwise, there's actually precious little, or I would almost say none, evidence that Scandinavians reached what is now the United States of America. When they reached North America, there's very good evidence for them reaching Newfoundland, Labrador, that part of northeastern Canada. But anything further south is largely speculation or fake evidence.
Okay, but that leads in very nicely to the next question from Muna Ahmed on Facebook, who asked, why did they not settle in North America?
Well, the people of Scandinavian origin, or Vikings, if you like, who went to North America largely came from Greenland. So there was a settlement in Greenland, which in itself had the people there had come from Iceland. So it's a kind of stepping stone across the North Atlantic. And the further you go, if you're still maintaining the culture of home, then you get further and further away from home, if you see home as Norway or Iceland. And of course, fewer and fewer people. I mean, Greenland, again, it's disputed, but I've seen suggestions that at its height, Greenland didn't actually have more than 2,000 people of Viking origin living there. So if a few of them go off to, you know, there's not enough people really for them to settle. And probably, I think it was, I mean, it was useful. We do have evidence that they kept going to Labrador for timber into the 14th century, because if you live in Greenland or Iceland, there's not many trees. So it's quite a handy place to go if you need big trees. So they went back and forth, but I think it was just too far away to live life the way they wanted to live it.
Okay. It's, I imagine it's a bit more than just going back and forth between Greenland North America. It's a bit of a trek, I would.
It is. It is, but it's not that bad, because if you sail up the Greenland coast and then down the Canadian coast, then you're following the coast much of the way. That's the easiest form of navigation.
Sure. Okay. Question from Peter Grunert on Twitter, who asks, I want to know more about Basil II and the Varangian Guard. I'm never sure how you pronounce that. Is it Varangian or Varangian? I'm not sure.
I say Varangian, but okay. You know, whatever.
Okay. I know it's not quite your specialist area, but do you have anything you can tell us about that?
It's a very interesting. It's the kind of extension of what I mentioned earlier, mainly Swedes heading east down through down along the Russian rivers, and one of their routes so they were basically trading all the way and then eventually reached the Black Sea, and then from there to Constantinople, as it was known then, or Istanbul, or Byzantium, if you like. And with Byzantium at this period was very wealthy and important. And Basil II, who ruled in the late 10th and early 11th century, was a great one for going on military expeditions all around the place. So he needed lots of soldiers, and all these handy young men from Northern Europe could go and earn a living by soldiering for him. So apparently he formed this Varangian Guard as his particular personal bodyguard. I think it played quite a large part in the lives of many Scandinavians, as quite a few characters in the Icelandic sagas are said to have gone to what they called Miklagarður, which means the big town. And for a time. So it's something that young men did, and one of the most famous ones, and he's even recorded in Byzantine sources and not just in Scandinavian sources, is Harald the Hard Ruler, the King of Norway. He's later King of Norway, who died at Stamford Bridge in 1066 before the other more famous Battle of 1066. And he spent his youth as a captain in the ranging guard, and was apparently very successful. And there's quite a lot of poetry about his raiding in Sicily and things like that as well.
Okay. It's a link to that sort of question, I suppose, in the same sort of area. This is from Rayhan Khan on Twitter, who would love to know more about the Volga Vikings and their trade with the Arabs, and particularly interested in the extent of primary sources about the Vikings in Arabic. And there's one chap who seems to get quoted a lot in Viking books nowadays, I forget his name. You'll know it, but there's definitely some evidence there, isn't there?
There's a lot of evidence. You're thinking of Ibn Fadlan, and exactly, you yes. might remember him from the 13th Warrior film. but he's not the only one. I'm going to come back to him in a second. But the point is that there's a huge amount of literature in Arabic about the encounters that people in those regions had with people from the north, who they called Arus, the Rus, which, by the way, gives its name to Russia. and these were largely Scandinavians, or at least of Scandinavian origin, but of course it's a big continent, and probably some of them were well established there. So the two main routes were the Dnieper, which I mentioned earlier, which led to the Black Sea and Istanbul, and then the Volga, which heads more eastwards. And Ibn Fadlan, in particular, that he was an ambassador from the Caliph of Baghdad to these people called the Bulgars, who lived on the Volga, and he encountered a group of Rus. He's important because he was an eyewitness. He actually traveled in those regions, met these people. He tells us that he spoke to them through an interpreter. So that's an interesting question. Somebody who could speak both Old Norse and Arabic, and a question of what got lost in the translation. And he describes a funeral of one of their chieftains, which is very well known. And most books about the Vikings mention it, but the original question, I think, is a more interesting one. There are very large numbers of Arabic sources. In this period, writers in Arabic were very interested in geography, and they wrote quite a lot of geographical treatises, and quite a lot of them include descriptions of these strange people in the north. And not all of them are eyewitness accounts, and there's a certain amount of just the same thing being copied over and over again. But it's a very, very interesting area of research, and there's very few scholars. I can really only think of one who know Old Norse and Arabic equally well to study these sources, because you do need to understand both cultures, I think, to really understand these sources. A lot more research is being done by archaeologists, because also the other good evidence for connections with the Arabic world is the amount of silver that came to Scandinavia to the whole of Northern Europe through Viking activities and Viking connections with that part of the world. And these are called dirhams, and the coins are extremely useful because they are actually dated, which is unusual for coins at that time. So we can get a rough idea of what's happening when because of these dates. Mm-hmm. Now, the Vikings didn't originally have a coin economy, so they valued that they generally melted the silver down, but enough of the coins survive, not having been melted down, to give us a good idea of how important that trade route to the east was.
Hmm. So who's that scholar who's got mastery of Old Norse and Arabic?
He's called Thorir Jónsson Hraundal. He's an Icelander.
Okay, because presumably that is an area where a lot of researchers will be looking to focus their attention then. Is there interest on the Arabic side? Are there Arabic scholars who are looking to sort of become Viking-esque?
There quite probably are. I haven't actually managed to meet any yet. And I think it's... I mean, even on a smaller scale, you have a similar problem studying Vikings in Ireland and Scotland, where you don't have that many people who can read the Celtic languages, the Gaelic sources and the Old Norse sources. They are hard languages, as you're discovering.
Yes.
And you really do need, and of course, studying Vikings in the East, you need other languages besides Arabic as well. You need Old Church Slavonic and so on and so forth. So, and people don't seem to like learning languages anymore. I don't know what their problem is.
Well, it's certainly an issue in a lot of aspects of history, isn't it? But perhaps particularly here, if there's research to be done. Okay, should we jump on slightly closer to home? How close did Normandy remain to Viking Scandinavian Viking outposts like the Kingdom of Dublin in the 11th and 12th centuries, socially, culturally, and politically speaking? And that is from someone called Montreal ST on Twitter.
Yeah, Normandy's interesting. It's also a relatively under-researched area, and I think a lot of scholars in France assume that apart from giving their name to Normandy, which is named after the Northmen, the Vikings didn't have that much influence. But I think in certain, nevertheless, I think there's probably more there. There's evidence from place names, particularly in the Cotentin Peninsula in Normandy. And of course, they ruled Normandy under the kings. So the connection is there. I think probably the settlement wasn't that widespread. But I can only go a little bit into the 11th century based on what I know at any rate. I do know that King Olaf of Norway, later saint, the first Scandinavian saint, spent his youth traveling around the European continent, and he did pass through Rouen. And one of his... there's a poem by his court poet Sigvatr, which mentions the fact that mentions Rouen. So probably at that time, there was still enough of an interest in meeting Scandinavians and listening to Scandinavian poetry in Rouen. This would be in the 1010s, this sort of very early 11th century. And then I suppose what happened, as in happened in England as well, that, you know, the contacts are maintained, but it's not that kind of explosive, extensive impact that you get with a period of raiding and settlement, that the people just have some kind of connection. But it's difficult to trace. But I'm told by colleagues in France that there's a huge archives of documents that haven't been studied fully. So that's another research project that someone needs to get stuck into.
Ah, okay. Well, but they'll be in medieval Latin, presumably. So yes. Be a few more people who could cope with those.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, we're finding where all the areas that people need to research. Should we jump on to the legacy? And a really easy question to ask from Google: what happened to the Vikings?
They never went away. we see, as I said earlier, I prefer talking about the Viking Age, and then you don't have to answer questions like what happened to the Vikings. And of course, it depends on the very first question, how you define Vikings. So obviously, some of them went home. Some of them stayed in new places and assimilated to local cultures, and then produced a kind of hybrid culture, which is, I think, what they did in England and Scotland and Ireland and places like that. Then I mentioned Iceland, which they established. There was nobody living there before, except possibly a few monks who wouldn't have produced future generations. And in Greenland, we do know that the Viking colony there died out in the 15th century at some point, or not later than 1500. We don't know why, because did they all leave because the climate was worsening, or did they just die out because there were so few of them, or did they go? We don't know. But that came to an end, and it's only in more modern times that Greenland once again was colonized by the Danes. So it's different everywhere, really. But in most of the places they went to, you can still see evidence of their impact, and in many cases, they became a part of the rich cultural tapestry of whatever country they settled in.
But as you said at the start, the sort of the historical terminology would have the Viking Age petering out towards the end of the 11th century.
Yeah. Well, of course, there was King Knut, who was the Danish king of not just England, but of Norway and Denmark as well. He died in 1035. I'm never very good on dates. His son, Hardy Knut, died in 1042. So some people would end the Viking Age in England in 1042. But then raiding activity continued well into different parts of Britain and Ireland into the 12th century. As I said earlier, Orkney and Shetland remained a part of Scandinavia. I personally think that many aspects of what we think of as the Viking Age continued. They crossed over the divide brought about by the coming of Christianity, and it's really only with the Protestant Reformation that life changed really quite drastically in many Viking parts of the world.
Okay, so we're taking it up to the 16th century now instead.
Well, 1500.
Okay. Okay, this is connected. Why do the Vikings, in quotes, continue to dominate the Western imagination, even more so than, say, the Greeks or Romans? Asked the questioner, who comments that they arguably left a larger and more tangible footprint, and that's Hjalg Sela on Twitter. So, do you agree with that comment?
It depends what you mean by the Western imagination. If you're talking about popular culture in 2020, then the questioner is correct. but if you're talking a bit more broadly about Western culture, then there are certainly, both in my university and other universities, many more people teaching the Greeks and Romans than the Vikings. Thank you very much. and our Western European culture has, of course, completely been dominated by the legacy of the Greeks and the Romans. Now, the Greeks, as far as I know, didn't really make it to Northern Europe. The Romans got as far as Scotland. so if you're talking about impact, do you mean impact of those cultures on the ground? Or do you just mean the intellectual legacy of Greeks and Romans? And I still think the intellectual legacy of Greeks and Romans is still much greater in Western civilization. However, two things. One is that there came a point where people in Northern Europe got fed up with the Greeks and Romans and started getting interested in their own Northern European history. And that's when the Anglo-Saxons, Celts, and Vikings were all discovered more or less at the same time in about the 16th century. But the real fascination with the Vikings is very largely, certainly in Britain, it started earlier in Scandinavia, actually, but in Britain it's very much a Victorian thing, 19th century. And to some extent we're still living through that romanticization of the Vikings that the Victorians started. But then in 2020, I would blame popular culture, starting with the Marvel comics, going through video games. I know very little about video games, but I know enough to know that an awful lot of them are heavily influenced by really the knowledge that the Victorians gave us about the Viking Age. And then there's the drama series like The Vikings on History Channel and Last Kingdom. And these have now, going back to my very first question, I think when most people think of Vikings, I'm pretty sure they're thinking of History Channel's Vikings first and foremost before anything else. So I don't really agree with the question, but at the same time, there is an interesting history to people's discovery of the Viking Age and Vikings and Northern European civilization, if you like, because after all, people in the North also composed literature and poetry and had philosophical thoughts, and it wasn't just a Greek and Roman phenomenon.
Yeah. And I mean, you're absolutely right in terms of popular understanding of Vikings, you know, as having gone through and looked for the Google searches about Vikings, they are the most of them are related to the TV series. So I wonder whether people struggle to disassociate Vikings from Scandinavia today in terms of, you know, there's been this thing in Britain, certainly, of a certain love affair with Hugger and things like that in Denmark and all the Scandi noir. Whether that's driving a certain interest.
Definitely. But that's only within the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, I've been around long enough to remember a time when nobody knew or cared about Scandinavia. Although, you know, again, that goes up and down in history. Obviously, in the war, the Norwegian government was based in London and the Shetland bus. And so there are, you know, in some ways, Scandinavia are practically our closest neighbours apart from France. There's always been connections there, and people's awareness of those connections goes up and down, and they are quite high at the moment. And to come back to your Scottish questioner, and one of the things that the Scottish independence movement has been very interested in is finding closer links with Scandinavia because of their Scandinavian heritage, rather than, you know, being ruled from London, if you like.
Okay, a couple more quick ones. I don't know how quickly you can clear this up, but CJ at Doctor Who 1970 on Twitter asks, where did the myth about the Viking horned helmets come from?
I can clear that up quickly. I just need to refer to my notes. In 1875, Richard Wagner's costume designer, Professor Karl Emil Doppler, for the first full production of Wagner's Ring at Bayreuth in 1876, came up with a helmet with cow horns on it for that production. There's a kind of history to that. It's really quite long and complicated, but I think you can say the Viking horned helmet was born in 1875.
Okay. And we are still in agreement that you shouldn't have a Viking horned helmet if you're depicting a Viking today. It's an anachronism.
It's a fun anachronism.
Okay, last one, and I know this is from someone who knows you. What is an S. Lewis Simpson?
Shannon Lewis Simpson.
Lewis Simpson on Twitter, who asks, "Who would you, Judith Jess, wish to compose your?" And I'm going to mispronounce this. Drapa.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, okay. And you're going to have to tell us what a drapa is.
Yes, well, I think Shannon possibly knows the answer to the question. But anyway, a drapa is a long praise poem. So before they started writing, they only started writing with the advent of Christianity and written culture. They had a very vibrant oral culture. And one of the things they did is compose these very long and very complicated and very difficult poems in praise of kings and chieftains. Sometimes while they were still alive, so you'd stand up and, you know, you imagine the chieftain having come back from a raid and all his men in the hall all drinking away, and you had to say nice things about the chieftain and then he would pay you afterwards. It was a very lucrative profession. So that's what a draupa is, basically. And of course, this is all very masculine, but there is one poet who actually composed a draupa about a queen. And she was called Ástríðr. She was the wife of Saint Olaf, who I've mentioned already. And Saint Olaf was martyred in a battle in the year 1030. He left behind an illegitimate son, so not her son. But everyone was very keen to get him back onto the throne of Norway after his father's enemies had kind of killed his father. And she was a Swedish princess. She used her, pulled strings in Sweden and got in some Swedes and put her stepson back on the throne of Norway. And for this really quite daring political intervention, an Icelandic poet called Sigvatr composed some poems about her that survive So it's the only one of this genre, it's a very extensive genre of poetry, which is composed in praise of a woman. So I thought Sigvatr was probably the guy to compose my Draupa.
Brilliant, brilliant. Okay, well, thank you for that. That's gone through all the questions we have. Mm-hmm. I suppose before we finish, we call this series the Everything You Want to Know About series. Are there any questions you were surprised that we didn't have? Are there questions that you're regularly asked when you deliver public lectures or anything like that that normally crop up?
Well, the genetics one is an interesting one. You brought that up, but I'm surprised that none of the questioners did. Nobody's mentioned runes. Runes are what I'm particularly interested in, and that's another aspect of Viking studies that has been heavily taken over in some ways by popular culture, and it would have been interesting to talk about runes and runic inscriptions as they were used in the Viking Age. But sure. Maybe another time.
Yeah, I think we can definitely do another podcast entirely on runes, I would imagine. I'm sure there's lots of interesting things to say about that. Judith, thank you so much. That was great. Thank you for going through all those questions. We've got lots of material there, so hopefully it will have answered the queries of the public about the Vikings and the Viking Age, and no doubt brought up some more queries and questions that they will have. And I'm sure they will follow your books and research as a consequence.
So they were great questions. So thank you to the people who bothered to send in questions.
Good stuff. One final point: have you? So I mentioned some of the books you've done. Have you? Mm-hmm. What's your next research project? Are you working on anything interesting?
Yes, I am working on a brand new, fully annotated and complete translation of Orkneyinga Saga, the saga of the Orkney Islanders.
Ah, okay, brilliant. That's I think I've got a copy of a Penguin translation there, but I'm sure yours will be much more interesting.
Yes, mine will be better in all kinds of ways.
How far away from fruition is that? Is that a long-term project?
It's quite a while. I've only really just started on it, so it'll be a 2 or 3 years.
Okay, well, that's something to look out for. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Professor Judith Jesh from Nottingham University. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Judith Jesh. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then please do drop us a line with ideas of topics and historians that you'd like us to include in the series. You can do that on our social media channels at historyextra.com. You can also find plenty more material on the Vikings at our website. Just head to historyextra.com/period/Viking. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back tomorrow when I'll be speaking to Mark Bostrich about Florence Nightingale.